Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. The last time we spoke to him, he had just summited Mount Everest. Now he has summited his sixth of the seven highest peaks in the world. Robert Ault of Columbus and the Profound Climbing Methodology is joining us today to discuss the challenges and rewards of climbing to the highest points on our planet. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So first of all, congratulations on summiting, on your latest summit. So it's Poonchak Jaya, is that right?
Poonchak Jaya or Karsten's Pyramid is what it's called. So this is one of the fabled seven summits, the tallest mountain on each continent, which I guess begs the question, what's a continent? Mountaineers are much better at climbing than we are at math and geography. So we actually say there are 9-7 summits, and in part
nine seven summits. You're not good at math either.
That's what I'm saying, and that's because there are a couple of disputed summits. There are two main lists of the seven summits. One was created by Dick Bass, an American, and it calls the highest point for this area Australia, Kosciuszko, because most Americans are taught that Australia is its own continent. But for much of Europe and a lot of the non-English speaking world, they would consider Australia to be part of Oceania. And in Oceania, you have the island of New Guinea, the second largest island on the planet, and it contains Karsten's Pyramid or Poonchak Jaya.
Okay. Wow. No, I did. I come from a school where I learned that Australia is a continent.
That's what I was taught growing up as well.
New information to me. Okay, so learning all the things. Okay, so this mountain, which is in New Guinea, how does it compare to Everest? Like, how tall are we talking here?
So it is about 16,000 feet tall, as opposed to Everest is over 29,000 feet tall. But it is the most considered to be the most technical of the seven summits. It is more of a rock climb, and when you're thinking about doing a mountain after Everest, I think you want there to be some unique challenges. And let me tell you, Poonchak Jaya does not disappoint. First of all, it's extraordinarily remote. The island of New Guinea, it's actually on the Papua Indonesia side, kind of like if you look at the Dominican Republic and Haiti, how the island is split politically. Similarly here, Indonesia has political control of one part. Papua New Guinea has control of the other part of the island. This is on the Indonesian side. But there are separatists who are not happy about the fact that they are part of Indonesia. So there are violent separatists who have been having uprisings for a while. In part because of this, in part because of some kidnappings that occurred on the way to the mountain. The mountain was closed for a number of years. American teams had been the previous way that you would get to this mountain was a 7-day hike through the jungle to get to base camp.
So you'd hike for 7 days before even bothering to climb the mountain.
Exactly.
Oh.
But there were a number of teams that got kidnapped on the way, and so a couple of years ago they began helicoptering the teams to the mountain. But then the violent separatists began taking pot shots at the helicopters. So as soon as it reopened, one of the helicopter pilots got killed. Just before I left for this expedition, one of the helicopters crashed. Another one was shot up more than 11 times, and the security firm that was guarding it, two of their security guards got killed. So this is a very dangerous part of the world. Indeed, while we were waiting, I waited in Tomica, the closest city where there was an airport to get to the mountain. We were basically on house arrest at the hotel for over a week just because of how dangerous and unstable the region is.
Wow. Do they not want people climbing this mountain, or do they just not want helicopters around?
That's a great question. I don't know for sure. I think it's more just to get because it gets some national attention.
Mm, I see. Okay. Well, you did make it. You did climb the mountain. You're here. So there, therefore. So you mentioned that it's challenging. So it's challenging to get to, apparently. It's challenging to, you know, get to safely. But then I was just sent a photo of you climbing a challenging part of it. We're on the radio, so describe this little bridge, and I'm using the word bridge lightly with air quotes, that you have to cross in order to summit this mountain.
So you have to do what mountaineers would call a Tyrolean traverse, or a modified Tyrolean traverse, what people in plain English would call a tightrope walk. So essentially, there is a rope strung over, I'd say it's over 100 yards long, and it's about 3,000 feet straight down, and you have to cross this from one point to another near the summit as part of the climb. All the while, the wind blowing, the rope swaying. And I should add something I mentioned last time when I talked about my Everest climb. I'm afraid of heights. And so this is one of the things that I overcome in mountaineering. And so picture, if you will, being afraid of heights and having to walk a tightrope over a 3,000-foot drop. It teaches you focus. You really just look at the next step on that rope and what you need to do to get across that tightrope.
Wow. I was looking at the picture, listeners, and it is literally a tightrope. And I asked off the air, I asked Robert why they couldn't build a bigger bridge. But I guess they can't.
I don't know. I suppose they could, but
it would probably get destroyed by the weather. But anyway, yeah.
Well, and the weather is another interesting challenge. They get a tremendous amount of rain. So on our summit day, on the way down, literally end up descending in, you know, the path that we took up on the way down looked like a river. There was so much rain coming down, so much water coming down the mountain. The region just gets a tremendous amount of rain. So weather is another big challenge on this mountain.
So you have a goal of summiting the 7 highest peaks, or 9 highest peaks, I guess, depending on which math you use. So you've done 6 of them. Is that 6 of the 7 or 6 of the 9?
That would be 6 of the 9.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So which one's next?
Next is Mont Blanc, which is the tallest mountain in Western Europe. Europe is another one of those continents that has, it's a little hard to define Europe as a continent. And so because of that, there are two mountains that vie for the title of tallest mountain. Mont Blanc is the classic, you know, highest classic Alpsklein climb in France, the tallest mountain in Western Europe. The tallest mountain overall in Europe is actually in Russia. It's on the Russian-Georgian border, Mount Elbrus. And that mountain is over 18,000 feet tall.
Okay. Have you done either of those?
I have not. Mm-hmm. I attempted Elbrus back in 2017 and unfortunately got sick on the climb, so we had to turn away before the summit. But an absolutely gorgeous mountain, very remote. If it were in the United States, it would be a ski destination because you can ski the lower slopes year-round. Looking forward to seeing that mountain again.
All right. Well, we'll circle back to you meeting your goal and summiting these mountains, but back to the mountain in New Guinea, Puncak Jaya, right?
Yes.
I got it. All right. So tell me what it was like to reach the summit there. The view, the feeling, talk about what it meant to you to hit this 6th peak on your list.
So first of all, after the long wait to get to the mountain, we had numerous problems getting a helicopter to get us there. The climb itself was just tremendous fun. The fact that it's technical and rock climbing, and it wasn't just that tightrope walk. There was a lot of, you know, sort of interesting and fun scramble, and to get to the top, this mountain, because of all the logistical challenges to get there, it felt like there was a good chance we weren't going to actually make it, and so it just a huge sense of relief and accomplishment, and it's just gorgeous. It is a beautiful mountain, and the view is just absolutely tremendous. To be able to actually, you know, hit my sixth summit, it was truly exhilarating.
That thrill / being scared because it's so dangerous is that a part of the joy you find in this? Do you enjoy the thrill of the scare?
Well, you know, the funny thing, if you know, if I'm feeling adrenaline as a mountaineer, I'm probably doing something wrong. I'm a lawyer by training, and I actually, the way I approach mountaineering is not in a way to take risks, but to mitigate risk, to control risk.
So you're trying to find the safest way to do what's in front of you.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly.
That's a very lawyer way to look at it, I think.
I agree.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Robert Ault, founder of Profound Climbing, and he just climbed Puncakajaya Mountain in New Guinea. So how would you say, I mean, you just mentioned you're a lawyer, like, how does your hobby of mountain climbing impact your day-to-day work? You work for the think tank, the Buckeye Institute. So I'm guessing, you know, lawmakers don't scare you because you climb mountains. Is that...
Well, I think that there are lessons for mountaineering that you can apply to everyday life. It is very mentally and physically challenging. And it really forces you to think about the incrementalism. You know, you can do really, and it's part of my methodology for profound climbing. You can do much more difficult things than you possibly imagine, particularly if you break it down, think about the next necessary step, and focus your efforts on that. That will get you to the top of the mountain and back. That will also help you to accomplish things in your daily life.
Yeah. Your profound climbing it connects the physical to the psychological, right? Both challenges are intertwined.
Absolutely. And I think once again, that reflects our daily lives. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes we don't think about the integration of that. And for me, it doesn't have to involve climbing, but for me, climbing adds that extra element of being in touch with nature, which I think, that's very grounding for me personally.
So this mountain that you just did, the sixth one on your list, how long are you allowed or can you stay at the top, like, to enjoy the view? Because I remember when you came on to talk about Everest, you get there and you don't have very long up at the summit, right? Yeah.
Yeah, traditionally, I think I had about 15 minutes at the summit, which is considered a good long time. I mean, some people spend longer, some people don't even get that. So for Puncakajaya, we actually had a nice time at the summit. I'd say we were up there maybe just short of an hour.
Oh, wow. So, okay. Because it's not as crowded as Everest or not as dangerous at the top?
Well, number one, not as cold. My summit day on Everest, it was so cold that if you had skin exposed, I mean, frostbite risk was real. And we also had, you know, some pretty serious wind weather that day. So Puncakajaya, you know, had serious rain, but the weather was not as big of an issue, so we were able to take our time a bit more.
Okay. Now, if I remember correctly, when you were coming down from Everest, you ended up getting sick and the descent took longer. Is that correct?
So I had gotten an upper respiratory infection on the way up, which had ripped through camp, so I was already fighting that. And then, yes, So with Everest, it's all about the weather. You're looking for a weather window when you don't have hurricane force winds at the top. You're normally looking for a 3 to 4 day window. We ended up with a 4 hour window to do a 20 hour climb. And what that meant is if we landed this perfectly, we would be standing on the top of the world without hurricane force winds, but we would have to climb down through hurricane force winds, which is what happened. So my Sherpa and I were being shoved 6 paces at times, you know, by the wind, you know, oftentimes on paths that were, you know, maybe 18 inches wide. So, you know, I estimate 85 plus mile an hour winds. So we ended up, because of this, we fought our way back to Camp 4, which is still in the death zone, that area where humans cannot survive for long without oxygen. And we ended up having to stay overnight in the death zone at over 26,000 feet. Really not advisable, but ended up being the right call, because by doing that, the next day when we descended from there, the winds had died down significantly.
Okay. So that sounds very, very scary. So this latest mountain, you had rain, but your descent was a little safer, a little more tame, right?
Certainly, I mean, in terms of weather, much safer. couple of interesting things happened on the way out. As I mentioned, there were all kinds of issues with the helicopters. Such a dangerous region. I've never had something like this before. At base camp, you had armed guards with automatic weapons on the edge of the camp, just given some of the issues with the violent separatists. But tempers were running hot at base camp, and you know there was a scrum to get on one of the helicopters, and some of the other clients nearly got into a fight as we were trying to get on our chopper. So it was it was a little bit stressful, but again a tremendous mountain and a great climb.
When you do the mountain in France next, are you expecting it to be a little tamer?
certainly more politically stable. And France, they have huts along the way, so you know France does climbing, you know, a bit more civilized. They have wine in the huts, I think.
Of course they do. So. Yeah. When are you planning on doing the, I forgot the name of the mountain in France.
Mont Blanc. Going to be doing that this summer.
This summer? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Only around 500 people have summited all seven summits, if I looked it up correctly. Is that about right?
That sounds right. I didn't even know it was that many, but that.
I don't know. It's just a Google search, so yeah. I don't have any science to back that up, but. How would you feel to be a part of that group?
It would be extraordinarily gratifying. I climb for a couple of reasons, and one of them is to honor my father. He was an OSU grad, got his PhD from Ohio State, and began teaching physics out in California. But he was also an endurance athlete. He's one of these guys. Why run 26 miles when you can run 50 or 100? And later in his life, he began doing some mountaineering. He went to Everest Base Camp in his early 60s. Did some other big climbs. I'd done some minor hiking with him growing up, but. He'd invited me for some of these bigger climbs, and it came at a time I was just starting my legal career, and there would always be time later. And of course, I mean, you can guess the end of the story. There wasn't. He passed way too early. And so as part of my climbing the seven summits, I carry him figuratively in my heart and literally in my pocket. I carry his ashes up to the top of each of these summits. So each of the seven summits that I have successfully climbed, I've spread his ashes, and I spread his ashes in October on Punchak Jaya when I summited that mountain.
Wow. Well, what a great tribute to him. That's amazing. Well, I guess we'll have to have you back after you climb the next one. This is going to become a tradition.
I look forward to it.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Robert Ault, mountain climber and founder of Profound Climbing. And you're from Central Ohio. I said Columbus, but you live around here?
Yeah. Yes, Lewis Center.
All right. Got it. Just wanted to be accurate. Thank you so much for joining us today, Robert.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we are going to talk with a local author who's working on a unique way to teach history. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. This local author fuses history lessons with ghost stories to create a fun and interesting way to learn Ohio history. Having written two books already in the Ohio Kids series and coming out soon with a third, Logan Lyon is continuing his family tradition of finding new and unique ways of teaching. Welcome to All Sides, Logan.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So when did you first discover or think, like,
you know, I like writing. I want to write a book.
Well, this book, the first book, The Chillicothe Ghost, that started when I was in eighth grade.
Hmm.
When I was in eighth grade, every kid in Ross County had to write a ghostwriting contest. Hmm. Everybody had to do it. No choice. So
I'm thinking you didn't want to at the time.
No, I did not.
Yeah.
Well, eighth grader would.
Yeah. So you wrote, so the heart of this story, did you write in eighth grade?
Mm-hmm.
And you saved it?
I did. I got to tell you this story really quick.
Yeah.
I was sick that day. They announced the winners. Mm-hmm. So I got into school late. I walked into the classroom. They're like, hey, you won the county ghostwriting contest.
Ooh.
My mouth dropped. I'm like, what? Like, yeah, you won it. I'm like, are you sure?
Mm.
Like, yeah, you honestly did.
Wow. So that winning in the eighth grade, did you tuck that away and save it for the future?
I did. I put it in my computer back then.
Yeah.
Fast forward to about 20 years later, I'm cleaning out my old computer. I found the story, and I'm like, you know what? Maybe I should try to make this into a book. One thing led to another, and that's all we got.
And now you have a book. Okay. So the characters in it are based off of you and your friends. Did you make that choice because of relatability to readers, or just because, you know, it's good to write about what you know?
A little both.
Yeah.
A little both. I based it on what me and my friends would do if we saw these people.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I knew a little bit about it, so I figured,
yeah,
hey, maybe kids could relate to this.
So what inspired you, though, to decide to do a children's book specifically?
One, I come from a family of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I was a teacher for a little bit. My mom was a history teacher for years. Mm. She's actually my biggest inspiration for this book. My grandmother was a teacher. We just like finding new and interesting ways to teach history to kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So your way you've decided to teach history to kids is through having some teenagers meet some ghosts, right? Mm-hmm. Are ghosts a good medium? I guess, do kids like ghosts?
Yeah, they like ghosts. Like, mm-hmm. every Halloween, you see ghost stuff all over television. So, mm-hmm. yeah, they love ghosts.
Yeah. So your first book focuses on several ghosts who are related to Ohio history, specifically related to, they have a tie to Chillicothe, right? Which is where you're from. How did you decide which historical figures to choose?
Well, Thomas Worthington, he had a big, big presence, not only in Chillicothe history, mm-hmm. but also in Ohio history, too. I didn't know if you know this, but he was also our sixth governor and our first senator of Ohio. So I figured
I learned that in your book. Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that either until I visited his home, the Adena Mansion, one day, and I learned that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this is really cool. So I figured that would be a good place to start.
Yeah. So the kids in your book get to meet Thomas Worthington and his wife. And basically, they learn the history. They learn about him, you know, but he's a ghost, right?
Well, it could go either way. Is he a ghost? Isn't he? Was it just some reenactor, or was it the real thing?
That's true. I know. Logan leaves a little mystery in the story for the kids. What ages are you hoping? Like, do you have an age in mind of who should be reading this book?
Yeah, like upper elementary, lower middle school, like third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, in that era.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough to get their attention, but short enough where they don't lose interest.
They can finish the book, yeah. And has enough information that they'll learn something.
It has enough to learn a little bit about Chillicothe. Not only Thomas Worthington, but Chillicothe as well.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it mentions Tecumseh.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know who Tecumseh is, he was a famous Shawnee Native American who was believed to be born in the area. I think it goes a little bit into the Majestic, mm-hmm. which some believe is the oldest theater in America. Mm-hmm. Talks about the history of that, too.
Yeah, you have a lot of Chillicothe history in mm-hmm. there. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with local author Logan Lyon. So tell me about how you came up with this idea that you were going to make it a series, because I'm thinking you started with one book, or did you start with the idea where you knew you wanted more than one book?
Well, actually, I just started out with one book,
mm-hmm.
and the publisher I talked to, he's like, can you write another story? This one's really good. I'm like, you want another story?
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, I guess I can come up with one really quick. I think, okay, who do I want to write about first?
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know what, I've been a big Elvis Presley fan since I was in high school. Not high school, middle school.
Yeah.
I've read 1,000 books about Elvis Presley, so I figured let's start with him. Mm-hmm. So that's how.
So the second book is The Ohio Kids Meet Elvis Presley.
That's correct.
All right. And you picked Elvis Presley purely because you like him.
All that. And he has a big importance on pop culture, whether you like him or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's rare for an artist to affect several generations, all the way from Bob Dylan to U2 to Taylor Swift.
Mm.
So that's
Yeah. Okay. So I only got to read the first book. And in the first book, the Ohio kids meet the Chillicothe ghosts. And it involves a cemetery. It involves deciding whether they're reenactors on Halloween or if they're actually ghosts. You know, that is all in there. Where are the Ohio kids meeting Elvis?
Where else? His home, Graceland.
Oh, okay. So the Ohio kids travel to Graceland?
They travel to Graceland. I don't want to give away too many details in the book.
That's okay,
but
yeah.
Somehow they end up in the Graceland. Mm-hmm. They're following their girls because teenage guys.
That's what teenage guys do?
Yeah,
okay.
Of course. And they see this character who looks like Elvis Presley, and they get a little jealous because this guy's good looking. He looks just like Elvis. They're like, hey, wait a minute.
We're supposed to be with these girls.
Yeah, not this dude.
Yeah. All right. So so I'm also told that there's a third one coming?
There is a third one coming out.
All right. Who's the ghost in that?
Well, I don't want to give away too many details, but...
Oh, I'm going to make you a little bit here.
All right. I won't give away
I don't think third graders through sixth graders are listening right now. They should be in school, so it's okay.
Yeah, they should be.
Yeah.
But while giving away too many details, it's going to be about the actor Jimmy Stewart.
Okay. What made you pick him?
Because I love his story. Mm. I mean, I love Elvis Presley's story, too, but I really love his story. If you all know who Jimmy Stewart was, he was a famous actor. During World War II, when everybody had to be drafted to go in the war, he didn't wait to be drafted. He was one of the first actors to go sign up.
Mm.
They told him, no, you're too skinny, so he had to build muscle and wait till he finally made the cut. A lot of people don't know this, but he is the highest-ranking military actor in military history.
I did not know that.
After the war, he continued to serve in the Air Force Reserves, made all the way to Brigadier General, highest actor in military history.
Okay, so the Ohio kids are going to meet him?
They're going to meet him.
Where do they have to travel to meet him?
They have to travel to his hometown of Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Indiana, Pennsylvania. Okay, I had forgotten he was from there. I grew up in Pittsburgh, but my grandmother is from Indiana, Pennsylvania. I completely forgot Jimmy Stewart was from there. See, you're teaching history left and right. So tell me about the idea of publishing a book. I mean, that is not an easy thing to do.
Definitely not.
So tell me, how did you end up publishing? How did you find a publisher? How did you go from A to B?
Well, Google.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
The honest answer, Google. Yeah. Then I send them to publisher after publisher after publisher, send them story, and I've gotten, like, we like the story, we just don't feel like it's for us, or no, we don't want to do it. So I finally found a publisher, a new one, relatively new, Huntsville, Alabama. Josh Adams, he just started up. He's a wonderful guy. He's like, I like this story. Let's publish it.
Wow.
So that's how we got it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you weren't afraid of hearing a few no's?
Not.
How many no's did you hear before the yes?
About 50.
Yeah. I can believe it. I thought you were going to say 100. Yeah. It's publishing is hard.
Yes, it is.
So so you have this third one coming out. So we have the Ohio kids meeting the Chillicothe ghosts, meeting Elvis, and then meeting Jimmy Stewart. Are there more to come?
There will be more to come. It will not only be about Ohio history, because there's plenty of Ohio history.
Yeah.
But it's going to be about U.S. history as well.
Okay. How many do you have in your back pocket here?
Right now, 3.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you there'll be more in the future.
Okay. So this 3 have been published and you have 3 more in the works?
There'll be, 2 published, the third one that will be.
Yes.
But I got more in the future.
Okay. And has your publisher talked to you about continuing the series?
We have talked about continuing the series, yes.
Okay. Okay. I wanted to talk more about how your mother inspired you, because you mentioned that briefly a few moments ago. So your mother is actually included as a character in the first book, right?
That's right.
How did she inspire you to become a writer?
Well, like I said, she was a history teacher. Mm-hmm. She's no longer with us, I'm afraid. She passed away a few years ago.
I'm sorry.
But she believed in me when not many people didn't. I had learning disabilities in school. A lot of people thought I wouldn't make it anything of myself.
Mm.
She was one of the few that encouraged me, yes, you can. You can. And she also drug me to every battlefield, every history museum she could growing up.
Mm.
She wanted to make sure I learned this. She was a wonderful woman. She had a heart for kids. She went out of her way to teach kids about history, English, whatever you can think of.
Mm.
She was my biggest inspiration.
What do you think she would think about you, not just being a writer, but writing about history?
Well, she would have loved it.
Yeah.
She would have been shocked that I was a writer. But I believe she would have loved it and would have been proud.
And tell me about, like, needing needing different ways to teach kids history? Because you mentioned that, I don't know if it was in another interview you did, or maybe it's on the back of the book, where you said that there's this is a different way to expose kids to history. Why do they need a different way?
Because kids learn different ways. Mm-hmm. Not every kid learns from reading the book. Some people learn visually. Like, I believe out in the lobby, you had clips about TV shows. Mm-hmm. Some kids learn that way by watching television. Mm-hmm. Like, I've known kids that they may not like reading the book, but if you show them the PBS documentary Baseball, they love that. And I've met kids who hate documentaries but love books. So I believe every kid learns differently.
Yeah. So tell me a little. You mentioned that you had a learning disability growing up. What was that like of trying to, you know, you had a mom who's a teacher, but maybe you didn't like school that much?
I loved learning, but I hated school. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is I loved learning about different things. I just didn't like being in a classroom for 8-9 hours at a time.
Yeah.
I have a very mild form of cerebral palsy. Mm. So it takes me a long time to convert short-term memory into long-term memory. So that was murder growing up. Teachers love that.
Okay. Well, what would your little kid self think about you now? You know, you're a published author. You're trying to teach kids history a different way. What would you say to yourself back then, now?
It's going to get better. Mm. It's going to take hard work, but you're going to make it, bud. I guarantee it.
And would that kid who didn't really like sitting in school 8 hours a day believe that he was publishing history books?
Not at all. He probably would have laughed at you or looked at you like you were crazy. Mm.
Where did you get, I'm looking at the cover and there's, you know, an illustration on the cover. Where did you get the artwork for the covers?
That was the publisher.
Oh, really?
I just told him what I wanted, my ideas, and he took care of the rest.
Okay. Are you happy with how they've turned out?
Yeah. I am.
Okay, so tell me what's next. When does the third book come out?
Oh, the third book is planned to come out in March.
Okay,
A date in particular, but the plan is about mid-March, late March.
Okay, and where can people, if someone's listening right now and they want to get one of your books, The Ohio Kids, for their own kid, where can they find them?
You can find them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart website, my publisher's website, HuntsvilleIndependentPress.com. Mm-hmm. I believe Wheatberry in Chillicothe, it's an independent bookstore. They still have a few copies left.
All right. Well, I love the idea of supporting the independent bookstore. So what's the name of that store?
Wheatberry Books, Chillicothe.
All right. Well, we have been talking with local author Logan Lyon about his new book series called The Ohio Kids. Thank you so much for joining us today, Logan.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And coming up, we're going to be talking about the beauty of stained glass, and we're going to meet the owner of a stained glass studio. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. In 1838, the G.C. Reardon and Company Stained Glass Studio was founded in Cincinnati. Almost 185 years later, in 1983, Jay and Linda Mormon founded the Beauvais Studios and merged with Reardon to form Beauvais Reardon Studios in Middletown, the oldest documented continuously operated stained glass studio in the United States. And joining us now is the owner of the studio, Linda Mormon. Welcome to All Sides, Linda.
Oh, good morning.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the history of this studio? Like, what was a stained glass studio like in 1838 when the original Reardon one was started?
Well, we have all the archives here that we can go through. And my husband tried to make the building that we bought and to make our studio out of. He wanted everything to look like it did back in that period of time. So you would have the beveling area where they made bevel glass for the stained glass windows. It was very, very scary looking to me because there was these great, great big wheels and stuff. And you know, they don't have the technology that we have today. So it was very crude machines, but they got the job done. There had been, back early on, they only had clear glass that may be colored. And where today they have what they call opalescent glass, where they have color put into the glass and then maybe add some white to get it looking like an opalescent glass. They're just the technology is still the same. They still have glory holes that they melt silica sand, soda ash, and limestone in, and metal oxides to get the different colors. If you ever have a chance to see them make glass, it's pretty cool because it takes at least three men, or maybe women now, I don't know, to make the glass. And that hasn't changed. I know that in Kokomo, Indiana, is where Kokomo Stained Glass, Opalescent Stained Glass Company is. You can go in there and watch them, and it's pretty interesting to see what's going on. When one guy's at one glory hole and another guy's at another glory hole, maybe two different colors, and they go across the room real fast and throw it on this table, and a guy mixes it up and then pushes it onto a table that pushes through to pushes the molten glass through to make it flat on the other side, and then they push it into another area to cool it.
Wow.
So that stuff has not changed one iota. It's still the same.
Wow. Yeah, that makes me want to look up a video now of how glass is made. I've never even thought about it before. But can you take me to 1983? Like, why did you and your husband decide that you wanted to start a stained glass studio?
Well, he started it as a hobby, and he became addicted to it.
Hmm.
And
you came along for the ride?
Well, yeah, we got married, I got pregnant, and I said, you have to get the lead out of our house.
Oh,
so
I see.
He made a studio in our garage, and he did that for a while. And he came to me. He's always begging me, please let me quit my job. I can do this. I know I can do this. And so finally, I said, okay, well, you can have somebody rent it during the day. You can do it at night, but you can't quit your job. So we took this place in a strip mall. And started and opened, and within, I don't know, it was 3 weeks or something, he quit his job on me and didn't tell me.
Oh.
I wasn't too happy.
Well,
but he did it.
Yeah.
And it's worked. And then it seemed like right out the gate, it was like 3 months into us having the studio out in the strip mall, we got a call from the Islamic Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's the biggest job still to date that we've ever done. And I just went there recently, and I was like, I can't believe we did that. Oh, my God, that is so beautiful because of the style of glass we use. And it's been a pleasure doing this, but we're also getting old, and we're thinking about retiring soon. But it's hard to walk away.
Well, tell me about the name, Beauvert. Is that French?
So, yes, it means beautiful glass.
Hmm. Okay.
And that was back in the day when we had, you want to be first in the telephone book.
Oh.
So we had a gentleman that was going to partner with us, and his name was Avante, and we had Beauvert. So when he backed out, we just went straight with the Beauvert instead of the Avante and Beauvert mixed.
Okay. And then at what point did you decide to merge with Reardon?
Oh, I couldn't tell you a date.
Mm.
I was in my 40s, and I'm in my 70s now, so it's been a long time ago. I can't remember.
That's okay. But you've shared there's a rich history behind the studio. There are works from the company in landmarks across Cincinnati. I mean, how does it feel for you and your husband to be a part of Cincinnati history with all of the stained glass?
It's pretty cool. My husband is a Cincinnati boy. He comes from Cincinnati. And I lived here in Middletown, Ohio, and he had to come my way because if we had kids, it was closer for me to be to the kid rather than him. But it's really cool because, I mean, Cincinnati's such a cool city anyway. And you know, the arts were all coming that way out of like West Virginia stuff. There was like a great, I don't know the word to use. People started moving in that direction to towards Cincinnati for the arts because there's so much. You got Rookwood and some other things. The stained glass studios they had there was, of course, Reardon, which G.C. Reardon came to the United States to become a painter and a sculptor. And he went to the Ohio Mechanics College, which is now part of the University of Cincinnati. So he came and you go forward years later, there was a young man by the name of Walter Baumbach that his father took him to a monastery to keep him out of a concentration camp. It's back when Tito was putting people in concentration camps. And he said to the monks, can you give my son a job? And they said, sure. So they put him in the stained glass studio. And in 1955, G.C. Reardon heard about Walter and got him to come to the United States. And Walter was the predecessor before us.
Wow. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the Beauvais Reardon Studios with owner Linda Moorman. Can you tell me a little bit about your retail offerings? If a visitor comes to your studio, what can they expect to find and what can they buy?
Stained glass tools to start the project and glass of all different colors. We don't carry everything, but we carry a lot.
Mm. And the stained glass shown on your website, I mean, it's beautiful. Some of it is ornate glass, as the kind you tend to see in historic homes, you know, homes of a certain era. Some are more artistic window treatments. Does this style remain popular no matter how tastes change? Does everyone love stained glass still?
Yes. Yeah, people walk in here and they throw their hands up to their chest and go, oh, my God, it's so beautiful in here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes us feel good to hear that because it's so inspiring. It's like, I don't know if you've ever sat in a church with stained glass windows and the lights coming through. It makes you feel like grace. It just makes you feel all warm and fuzzy when the light comes through and you see all the different colors.
Yeah.
That glass didn't come into play until the late, somewhere in the early 1900s. Before that, they only had clear or cathedral glass, like red, blue, and green, and they had to stain or paint it to get the different colors. And then they invented opalescent glass next, which was the cathedral glass with white glass mixed in, and then they mixed it up, and so it's more translucent than transparent.
Hmm. Do you get hired to do projects that are restoring stained glass, or do you make new stuff from scratch most of the time?
We do both.
How does it feel to go into maybe an old church or something like that and see stained glass that needs a little tender loving care and fix it up? How does that make you feel?
It's like, you know, the churches and the restoration, I think, has got us through all of our hard times. Because there's so much of it out there that needs restored. So, over time, the lead starts stretching and then the glass kind of starts falling out. And so we have about three churches in here right now that we're restoring their glass. We take it all the way. We make a rubbing of it, just like you used to do tombstones. And so you have to, because we have no pattern to work from. So we make a rubbing of that window, and then we start disassembling it. We do it all underwater because of we don't want to breathe lead. So back in the day, they used to put red lead in the putty. Mm. The putty is what goes around everything, and so we make sure that we're not exposing ourselves. And the ladies that work here, they put their mask on and just make sure they do all the things proper to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. When you repair it now, I'm guessing you use a different technique. You don't need to use red lead.
Yeah, we have a different way of putting. Yeah. But basically, still the same way. You know, you got to make a rubbing, take it apart, put it back together, solder it, putty it. It's just, it's a very long process, but we are repairing windows that are over 100 years old.
Mm, yeah.
That's longevity.
Yes, definitely. And then your windows will last another 100 years?
Absolutely. Or more.
Or more. All right. And you offer classes too, or like workshops. You want to teach the next generation of stained glass lovers, right?
We do. In fact, quite a few of our employees have come out of our classroom. They decide they like it that much, and we hire them.
Wow, that's great. Is it a difficult skill to learn, or does it just take patience, or is there a certain type of person who works with stained glass?
I think when I've actually been in the classroom teaching for a few years, I only ever had one person that just walked away and said, I don't like this at all.
Okay. So it can be for everyone. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but most of it, I know last night we have a group of sisters that's dad did stained glass, and he's going to give his stained glass tools and glass over to them to start making beautiful things at home. And we have all different people that come and want it. And mostly half of the class or more comes back and takes more classes.
So for those sisters who want to, so they want to do what their dad did, but maybe they want to learn from you, the experts, so they know they're doing it right.
Yes, it does help, especially when there's some glasses that are tougher to cut than others.
So you mentioned earlier, you've been doing this for quite a while now. Do you have plans for the future of the studio to keep the legacy alive?
We're trying to find somebody that would like to take it over and love it like us and our forefathers have loved it. Yes, we would. We don't want it to just close out. We want it to keep going.
Okay, so you're looking for someone who can love the stained glass and keep the studio going, but you haven't found that person yet?
Yes, correct. So if any of your listeners out there are interested, they should give us a call because it's so rewarding and it's so pretty just sitting in here, and it's inspiring. And you know, the stained glass windows tell stories to people. Like back in the hundreds of years ago, they had no way to teach the peasants their Bible stories, so they taught them through stained glass windows.
Oh wow,
they'd make a scene. You know, like if you go to churches, you'll see multiple scenes, like if it's St. John's, multiple scenes about St. John's, or multiple things about Jesus in different windows. So, but they were learning tools, and they still are today. But you know, people don't even look; they just accept that it's there and they don't think about it. So, I had a thing here in town where we put a bunch of people together, and we went to all the different churches, and you know, all these people went in these churches all these years. They didn't know that was what that story was on that stained glass window in their church. So that's kind of a cool part when you go in and you see the different windows and different techniques, different styles of painting. That does change over the years, the different type of the drawings we do are called cartoons. So they will do a scale drawing, a cartoon, because it may be, let's say, 24 by 36. But in reality, in the church, they may be 10 times that because of the big, tall windows. And it's awesome to go in a new church and see the windows. And I wish I could. I'm not talented. I can make a stained glass window. I cannot stain or paint. I know how, but I don't have the myself. I'm not a good artist drawing.
Well,
I can
hope,
make it, but I can't draw it.
Well, I hope someone listening to this takes the time the next time they're in a church or a place with a stained glass window and takes a closer look at it. Maybe you probably inspired them to do so. And I wish you luck. I hope you find someone to take over the studio and love it like you do.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking about the Bovaer Reardon Studios with owner Linda Moorman. The studio is the oldest documented, continuously operated stained glass studio in the United States. Linda, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.